Welcome back to another episode of the Tiga Tactics Podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Evan Preparis, and joining me, I have the founders, Dr. Conrad Bowie and Patrick Wong. Conrad, say hi.
Hey, hello, everyone.
And Patrick.
What up, podcast peoples?
All right. Well, I'm going to turn it over to Conrad for a minute because we're changing up a little bit of the format for this one. So, Conrad?
Right. Yeah, thank you. I'm very excited for this one. We're going to do focus on our friend, brother, Evan. And, you know, I'm very excited for this one because I'm sure everybody's wondering, who's the sexy man behind the sexy voice here? And not only that, you have an incredibly amazing background. You've lived several lives already with your accomplishments. So I'm very excited to jump right into this. You know, let's just start with your background. I don't know if we all know this, but a lot of us know that you're a member of the armed forces, the special forces, and we'd love to see or get from you how you got there and tell us a little bit about your childhood.
Yeah. So I grew up in Long Island, New York, so right in the middle of Nassau County there, kind of upper middle class household, one sister, father and mother. And it was all suburbs. I was always like a skinny, kind of like slightly awkward kid. So if you've ever seen the TV show The Goldbergs, I'm like the clone of the main character. Like, I'm not close. Like, he is exactly me. It is like we'll watch episodes and it is scary how accurate it is. It's like, did this guy copy my life? So that's pretty crazy. Just kind of nerdy. I wouldn't say I got picked on a little bit in like elementary and high school, but not like, it wasn't super bad. It seemed like maybe slightly above average. So nothing too crazy. I was kind of a weird kid in school. Like when I graduated senior year, I was voted most theatrical because I was primarily involved in plays and musicals. I was in six musicals in high school. Seen together with one of my friends, and then I most likely to get abducted by a UFO. That was my third kind of like award. Supposedly I won most likely to conquer the world, but they only let you win three, so that they pushed that over to someone else. So
that's so funny. So I take it it's a pretty normal upbringing, so to speak. What made you want to get into the military? Was it, did you have like uncles, your father in the military, or did you just watch a lot of G.I. Joe?
It was mostly G.I. Joe and Boy Scouts. So I wasn't an athlete growing up. I think I played soccer a little bit in like elementary school and early high school. And then I did cross country at end of high school, but it was terrible. I think I scored points for the team once because everyone else was sick. Boy Scouts was like my big thing. And I liked the service. I liked the uniforms and the patches. And it was, my Boy Scout troop was like, it was in the church, but it was super militarized. So like, we all had like giant knives, and like some of our Boy Scout ships, you go to the range and shoot guns. So it wasn't like a normal Boy Scout troop. And we held boys in that Boy Scout troop. Like they kept coming back usually until they aged out, until they were like 17, 18. So a lot of the troops we went to summer camp with would like, but at like 14, their troop would just start falling apart. But you know, we all got along, and you know, a lot of those guys were in like my wedding party, you know, a decade plus later. So
are you an Eagle Scout?
I am. I got Eagle Scout at like 15. Got like 60 merit badges. So like super nerd and always like hyper focused. When I found something I liked, I would like deep dive into it. And Boy Scouts was one of those things.
Why don't you explain to people who've never been a Boy Scout what it takes to become an Eagle Scout?
So yeah, there's like 21 or so merit badges you needed. So that's like the minimum. About 11 of them are required. They have to do with you know, nation service and community service and first aid and camping and all these various things. And then the other like 10 or so are electives. And then you have to do a big project at the end where you do some sort of large community service project. I collected food in a bunch of different neighborhoods and donated it to the Salvation Army. So it's like this big project. Everyone does something slightly different. And it's really up to you to plan, execute, and then kind of like conduct a after action review type thing and put it into a book and then present it to the board. So it's a pretty big step for like a teenage kid. Yeah.
Wow, very cool. So you're a Boy Scout through and through then.
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Yeah,
And
you know,
what?
I'm sorry, Patrick. I was wondering about you talked about knives and guns. How old were you when you were handling these tools here?
I remember getting my first knife as a Cub Scout when I got like my basic, you have to pass like a safety exam. So I think I was probably like 8. And then I really started getting to knives probably like early, like probably 11, 12. And then we started shooting guns at summer camp. I think the minimum age was 12. So that's when I started shooting like 22s. And then as we got a little bit older, there was a shooting range near in Pennsylvania that we used to go to. And they had like, you could pay, I don't know, $10 and shoot or clip through like any gun. And they had like Uzis and, you know, the handgun from Terminator 1 and, M1 Garand, like everything. And it was just a super cool experience. So
And so what was the impetus to go into the army?
a lot of the older boys in the Boy Scouts were, I wouldn't say a lot. We had a couple going to, like a couple went into the Marines, went to West Point. And I just kind of viewed it as a continuation of Boy Scouts. Like it was same type of people, except now you have bigger guns and more weapons. And the service is still there. It's just instead of being like to community and like community service projects, you're serving your nation. You know, so I wanted to do that. And then when I started looking into it, they're like, oh, we'll pay for college. And I was like, oh, cool. You pay for college? That takes a financial burden off my parents, like a pretty substantial one. So I applied for a program called Reserve Officer Training Corps. So essentially, I went to a normal college, and then like one of my classes each week was Army class, and that's kind of how I paid for college and had a job lined up afterwards.
That's very cool.
Well,
And
what did
what?
you major? I'm sorry.
No, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, what did you major in college?
So I was a double major, psychology and economics. Couldn't pick one, and I by the time I decided on psychology, I had already so many credits that it was might as well double major at that point instead of a minor. It was essentially the difference between one semester of doing all economics and one semester of, you know, taking some easier classes. So double major. I went to Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, which is where I'm with my wife. She went to Loyola down the street, and then that's also why I tend to go to the Maryland seminars because my wife's family's from that area. So.
Very cool. That's awesome. So you have that family connection, and what? So being in the army is one thing, but then being in special forces is a whole nother level.
Yeah.
And for people who aren't in the military, they're not familiar with the military. The term special forces is very specific. You know, a lot of
Yes.
people use it generically, but it actually refers to a specific branch of the army. And basically Green Berets, right? That's another term that they use for people who are in special forces. So maybe describe that for people who don't understand what you do and why you ended up getting into special forces.
Yeah, so Special Operations Forces is the umbrella term. So Special Operations Forces includes subunits like Navy SEALs. It includes Marine Special Operations. It includes Green Berets or Special Forces, as it's called. It includes other special mission units that we usually don't talk about very often. And Special Operations Aviation Regiment, the Night Stalkers, and Ranger Regiment. So if you've seen Black Hawk Down, it's basically like all the units in Black Hawk Down, plus a couple other ones. So Special Operations Forces, that's the generic umbrella term, kind of like mixed martial arts is an umbrella term, and then like UFC is a brand within mixed martial arts, and you know Shamrock and whatever other professional fight league are in that umbrella. Going through college, I tried out for a fraternity called Pershing Rifles. It's a military fraternity, co-ed, and essentially it was not like a normal fraternity pledge period. There's no drinking. It was just a lot of exercise and I'm gonna say tough activities. I'm gonna use that nice vague term there. And the group I pledged with and then ended up spending most of my time with were like all really into infantry, and they wanted to do all the army stuff. And hanging out with them, the experience I had in Pershing Rifles, they were like, well, if you're going to go into the military, like, why don't you do something you can't do on the outside? And going into the military, I wanted to be like med service or intelligence or something like that, kind of use my brains, my book smarts. And then the longer I hung out with those people, the more I was like, no, I should do something that kind of is unique and you can't do on the outside world. So I decided to get, I put infantry down, and my first choice, artillery, is my second. They gave me my second choice, artillery, which is shooting the big cannons. Went on a deployment, actually went on two deployments, and then I eventually tried out for special forces. And what makes special forces unique compared to the other special operations forces is they do unconventional warfare. And unconventional warfare has a very specific definition. It's activities taken to coerce, disrupt, or overthrow an occupying power or foreign government through a auxiliary, underground, and guerrilla force. So the prime example I used to use for a lot of time was September 11th happens. CIA and special forces guys go into northern Afghanistan, use the Northern Alliance, and use them to overthrow the Taliban. A better example, and I'm excited because you guys are going to get this because I speak to high schools and they always give me blank looks, is the Rebel Alliance links up with the Ewoks and overthrows the Empire in the Battle for Endor. And all the high school kids I talked to are like, well, I don't know what you're talking about. And I was like, did your parents not show you Star Wars? Shame on them. Bring them in here so I can yell at them. So
that's awesome.
Return of the Jedi, yeah.
That's awesome. I never thought about it that way, but yes, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, the Rebel Alliance is like, that is UW. That is unconventional warfare. Those are, that is the, they're Space Green Berets, essentially. Yeah.
Very cool. And, you know, explain to people what selection is and how hard that is.
So selection is a 3-week tryout process. And then once you pass that, there's a 14-month training pipeline before you get your Green Beret and your Special Forces tab. The selection process, there's actually a documentary out about it called 2 Weeks in Hell, because at the time it was only 2 weeks when they filmed it. Long story short, there's a bunch of psychological tests to make sure you fit the correct personality and don't have any sort of like major psychological disorders. You do a lot of fitness stuff, physical fitness tests. You do a lot of unknown distance runs, unknown distance ruck marches. So they'll line you up at a start line and they'll say, all right, complete the course as fast as you can. Follow the signs, go. And are you running 3 miles? Are you running 5 miles? Are you running 10 miles? You don't know. No one knows. So you just kind of run and follow the signs. Kind of whoever wins, wins. And they don't tell you the standard. They don't tell you the timeline. They don't tell you what's going on. So it's a lot of unknowns. And they don't give you feedback. So you never, when you do good or when you do bad, they just stare at you. They're like, okay, next event. And like, they'll come up to you with a notebook and like jot down notes. And sometimes they're writing bad stuff. Sometimes they're good stuff. Sometimes they're just messing with you. Sometimes they literally walk up to you just to kind of, you know, mess with you. They scribble in their notebook, nothing, just doodling. And at that, we started with about 320 people. We had 200 finished. So 120 people self-selected. They said, I'm not good enough. I don't deserve to be here. And they quit. And then out of those 200, 120 got picked to continue on to the 14-month training pipeline. So when people always ask me for advice about going, I'm always like, well, it sounds stupid, but like if you quit, your chances of becoming a Green Beret are zero. So don't do that. But like, I mean, you look at the finishing percentage and there were so many guys. I mean, I don't know how many would have passed, but there was a lot of guys, I'm sure, that were doing just fine. But because they're, I don't know, unconfident with yourself, or uncertain about the situation, they quit. And so you do that. You do a lot of land navigation, carrying your 50-pound backpack through the woods. And then you do a bunch of team week events. So they make sure you can work as an individual. Then they make sure you can work as a team. And essentially, they'll give you like a bunch of sandbags, rope, and poles. And you and your 10 friends have to carry, drag, or construct the contraption and then kind of move it from point A to point B, usually a couple miles. So to give you an idea of how much energy I'm exerting, I was eating 3 meals a day and I lost about 20 pounds in 10 days. I mean, weight's just falling off. Like we're moving so much weight through like sand. If I hadn't physically been there to do it, I would not believe it was possible. So the benefit is you do get, I don't say a lot of sleep, but you got like 6 hours of sleep a night. So it was more sleep than some of the other Army courses I'd been through at Rangers, like Ranger School. And then it also had a definitive end time. So Ranger School is a 2-month course. And if you fail a phase, you may have to redo it. So theoretically you can be there for beyond 2 months. Like I took the extended tour, the 6-month tour, do not recommend. but selection is 3 weeks, regardless of how you're doing it, 3 weeks, it's over. And they'll tell you if you passed or failed.
Yeah. So was there anything easy about selection or was everything just incredibly hard?
Actually, it's like it's kind of like combat in that there's a lot of like sitting around in boredom, and then there's like periods where you're like, well, this is like the worst day of my life right now. Like, this is not good. I am not having fun. I am exhausted and I'm hungry, and you know, my teammates are arguing with each other. So it kind of comes in waves, but there's actually a decent amount of like just sitting around and like BSing in between events, because they have to like reset stuff and get stuff ready. So you just kind of sit around most of the day. You're not allowed to sleep. You just kind of stare at each other and make friends with the other people on your team. And then they're like, all right, it's time to go. And not much yelling, just kind of like, here's the task, execute. And then you just suffer. Yeah.
Repeat. And what was the next step after that? You mentioned that there's training, right? You're just not like, oh, I'm a Green Beret now. Just
right,
so you got
right.
Selected.
Yeah. So there's a 14-month pipeline. 6 months of it is language. So everyone gets assigned a language. So based off of a region of the world, my region I was assigned was Middle East, and the language they gave me was Persian Farsi, which is what they speak in Iran. So it's an Arabic script. It's written right to left. I have probably the vocabulary and ability to talk of like a first grader, to give you an idea. So you basically know some basic pleasantries. And the reason you do that is because, so when you go into a foreign country, I'm like some random white dude showing up on their doorstep, and if I show up speaking some of their language, they're like, you know some of our language? And it immediately builds that relationship right off the bat. And then as a teacher, so Green Berets are essentially teachers, but we teach other countries and other militaries and friendly forces how to kill and blow stuff up. So you know, if you know the phrase like, and then you do this, I can teach you almost anything, right? Because I say, and then you do this, and I demonstrate loading a magazine, and then you do this, and I put the magazine in, and then you do this, and I pull the charging handle back, right? So it allows us to use some of those skills downrange. So 6 months of language, 2 months of something called small unit tactics. So essentially a tactical phase where you put on your backpacks, walk through the woods, and practice ambushes and recons and attacks and stuff like that. You do a 1 month course called SEER, Survival, Escape, Resistance, and Invasion. If you've seen the movie G.I. Jane, it's in the movie G.I. Jane, which is actually the parts that seemed very Hollywood were actually more accurate. And the parts that seemed that you would think would be accurate are actually more Hollywood. It's kind of backwards of what you'd expect if you watch that movie. But they actually, the SEER in that movie is actually not bad. But that's like wilderness survival, like all of Boy Scouts condensed into a week. And then you do some training on like how to behave as a prisoner of war. And then they capture you as a prisoner of war, and you hang out in America, quote unquote, I'm using air quotes here, American POW camp, right? And these people treat you like a POW for several days. And it is awful. Like, people lose, it's crazy. People lose touch with reality while they're there. Some of them forget they're in like a training environment. Like, I'm sure you've seen in like high stress martial arts drills, like people go into the black and they're almost non-functional. Like it happens there. And we had people arguing, like, so our instructors would bring up politics to try to get you to say stuff incriminating against America. And, you know, with the two-party system, people tend to fall on one side of the line pretty hard. And they would bring up politics in a training environment. We're supposed to be in prisoner of wars, and people are like bashing the current president. And I was like, we're like, what are you doing? We're training. Sit down, man. And they're like, no, the president, blah, blah. And you're like, oh, no. Oh, no. We're going to get beat up so bad for this. So that was pretty unpleasant. We could do a whole episode on that. I got so many stories from that. You do a 3 month MOS phase, military occupation specialty. So everyone has a specialty in special forces. So it's weapons, communications, engineer, which includes building and blowing stuff up, medical. And then as an officer, essentially yours is mine is planning, which is the least sexy out of all the options. But it is important and it is necessary. So you do that for 3 months. And then the final phase is a 1 month course called Robin Sage, where you pretend North Carolina is a foreign government and you infiltrate North Carolina. And then, again, air quotes here, overthrow the government of North Carolina. So there's also, it's like, our instructors would hate when I would use the term. We'd be like, oh, we're LARPing. And they're like, we're not LARPing, guys. And we're like, we're LARPing. We're going to LARP so good. They're like, stop using that. We're not LARPing. It's like live actual role playing. That's exactly what we're doing. But yeah, it's a scenario based, and like people in the town are in on it. The police are in on it. So police will stop you during some of these exercises, and you're not in a military base. I'm in a random town or in the middle of North Carolina, and they'll come up to you and they'll be like, "Welcome to Pineland." And that's the cue that we're in scenario, versus if he comes up to me and is like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "Oh, hi, my name's Evan. I'm part of the military. This is part of a military exercise. That's the reason my truck is full of guns." Right? Because there's been incidents in the past. So that's how they kind of differentiate that. But, you know, for 2 weeks, I lived in some dude's backyard, you know, a large property in the middle of North Carolina. You know, me, my guys, essentially actors or role players, and like with machine guns in the middle of North Carolina. It is wild. It is pretty wild. Yeah. Wow. And then you get your Green Beret. That's it. And then you go to a team. So.
Wow. That's crazy. So, you know, you talked about all this training. It's very diverse, all kinds of different things. In the movies, they make it seem like that you're like a one-man army. You're a Terminator. You can kill anybody. They give you all this training. You're deadly with anything in your hands. How true is that? What kind of training do you get in the special forces?
That's a good question. So it's kind of a mix, right? So the type of person that is attracted to that, so you get a bunch of training from the military, but then the type of person that's attracted to that is not just like part of our job, it's part of our who we are. So the same type of people that are interested in doing this job of special forces are the same type of people who will go out during their free time and shoot guns, compete in shooting competitions, learn martial arts, do Brazilian jiu-jitsu, train knife stuff, right? You get those personalities, run ultra distance races, right? Those personalities like overlap a lot and they feed into each other, right? So the more I hang out with people at work, the more skewed my personality becomes, because we start feeding off each other. There was times in the last couple of years when, like, you know, there's political and societal stuff going on, and I was just so confused. I was like, do people really believe this way? Because I was just stuck in my like special forces bubble where there's like no excuse for failure, right? It's like, I mean, when you fail, it's shameful, right? Like, it's like, there's just no excuse, because if I fail doing some training stuff or doing some personal stuff, then I'm same type of, it like failure begets failure, right? I'm going to go down range and fail, and then I'm going to fail on my buddies. And then you just can't have that down range, right? So like quitting is looked down upon, especially it starts in selection, because when you quit in selection and you're doing one of those team events, they don't reduce the amount of weight and the amount of things you have to carry. It's like, cool, you have one less person. Looks like everyone else is carrying another 10%. And you're like, damn it. Right. So that kind of carries over onto the team. It carries over into the rest of our training. There's not a lot of hand to hand stuff. We do have some combatives programs, but a lot of it is obviously a lot of it's rifle based and pistol based. That's kind of the primary. And a lot of it is just like hold someone off until your buddy can come over and shoot him type stuff. Sure. So we try to, where I work now and the combatives we teach, we try to enhance that more, so you're a little more comfortable going up and down the force escalation line there. And so you have a little more control. So when you do have to go hands on with someone, yeah, you can better choose the correct path as opposed to, but we found that when we do a lot of training, if you don't give people any hand to hand experience, they will default to shoot regardless. Right. Mm-hmm. So like, I don't know what's going on. I can't handle this guy. Boom. And you're like, well, he probably didn't need to be shot. Like, there's second and third order effects that are going to come from that. So, the cool thing about special forces compared to the regular militaries, right? So there's all these military schools, airborne school, air assault school. You get a bunch of patches, Pathfinder. So I got a bunch of patches and pins on my uniform. That is the lamest stuff that we do. In special forces, if you can justify how the skill set relates to your mission, you can do it. Right. So example, I could have hired you two and come to my team and teach, you know, self-defense for when working in a low visibility environment. Right. Because of a lot of our strikes and the EDC carry stuff transfers, I would say one for one over. We had guys go to photography classes, lock picking classes, offensive driving classes, body language reading classes, all sorts of stuff where There's nothing. I don't get anything on my military record, but I get a certificate from some civilian who is, that's his one area of expertise, and he trains that very well, and then he gives me those skills. So, long, long answer there.
No, that's very cool. Yeah, I bring it up because, you know, Connor and I have been teaching, you know, civilians for a long time, and if they don't know who we are, they'll say, "Oh, what do you know about knives? Or what do you know about fighting? Or what do you know about, you know, punching and kicking? You're not special forces. You're not in the military." And my retort is, because I know a lot of people in the military, I tell them, "Well, actually, in the military, you don't really learn knives or punching or grappling or, you know, any of the non-firearm stuff." And so there's kind of that stereotype that, like I said before, that you're all Terminators, that you can pick up anything and you'll automatically know what it is and how to use it.
So the phrase we use is jack of all trades, master of none. So we get a little bit, just enough to be functional in like a whole bunch of fields. But when we want someone who's an expert, I hire someone like Conrad and Patrick. But I would hire you two and come in and teach. The guys who we taught had taught us long range shooting. That was some civilian that came in and taught, because that's all he did. At one point we did have a guy come in and work some knife stuff. And again, that's all those people did. The lockpick guy, he only does lockpicking, right? So he comes in, teaches us as much as he can in a short period, and we get a basic functionality in it, and then kind of take it out for the rest of the mission. So now you guys are the people that we hire are specialists. That's exactly what they do. They know that topic that's better than the guys on the actual teams. I'll say that.
Interesting. Very cool.
And so would you consider, you know, once you were put into the field, was your training adequate? Did you feel that it was adequate? Was it too much? Was it too little? What were your thoughts on the curriculum there?
It's never enough. You know, you can always have more. You always want more. My first two deployments were before I went into Special Forces. It was when I was in the 101st. So I actually graduated college, went through like the basic training course. We went through Ranger School, showed up to my unit, and they were like, "Go home and see your family for 2 weeks. We're leaving for Iraq." And I was like, "Cool." So I didn't get an apartment. I went home, saw my family. I got on a plane, went to Iraq for a year, was back for a year, went back to Iraq for 14 months. And then I went to the Special Forces training pipeline. So my first deployment, it very much felt like being thrown into the fire there, into the wolf. You're like, "All I've done is Ranger School. Like, I'm still hungry and sleepy from Ranger School." And they're just like, they're like, "Welcome to Iraq. Be careful. There are bombs out there." And you're like, "Sweet." You're like, "This is going to go well." And the Army in general, specifically for Iraq, right? Like, the Army is designed for large scale conventional warfare, like fighting Russia, fighting China, fighting North Korea. That's kind of what we train for. And when I went to Iraq in 2005 for the first time, it was counterinsurgency, not something we'd been specializing in for the last 20 years. So the learning curve was pretty steep, and we had to really adapt on the fly. And I remember being in Iraq and being like, "Why didn't anyone train us for a lot of like the nuances of counterinsurgency?" Just like, well, it's kind of the way the Army prepares. You know, there's a risk-reward ratio. The risks are a lot higher in large-scale combat. Like a war with Iraq, like China or Russia, right? Because there's like tanks shooting at tanks, and there's aircraft flying in and blowing stuff up. But that stuff is, when you look at history, that is less common. Those are brief periods in history, and counterinsurgency is the norm, is more normal, right? We did high intensity conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan for like a year each, and then another, you know, 12 years and 19 years respectively of counterinsurgency, right? So you can just see it in those two wars alone. And you look at, we can go back through all of history and the ratios look very similar. But if you lose in large scale combat arms, right, it is substantial. You will lose a lot of lives. It is embarrassing on the world stage. So the Army kind of weighs out how they prepare for those things. I would, again, just my personal opinion, I would argue we sometimes spend a little too much time on high intensity stuff and not enough time on some of the counterinsurgency stuff, but I'm also a special operations dude. So there's a saying that when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? So like, mm-hmm. I'm a special forces hammer, UW hammer. So I think more the counterinsurgency mindset. Yeah.
And right. Oh, go ahead, Patrick.
Yeah, I mean, you've been deployed all over the world, been in obviously combat situations. You probably can't talk about any specifics, but what's the one or maybe top three things that you kept in mind to keep yourself alive, basically?
I'd say the first one is staying calm. So as an officer, I'm a leader. So typically when we're out on patrol, because usually we're operating in smaller elements, I'm usually the quote unquote highest ranking person on the ground in that element. So staying calm was always really important because fear spreads through the unit very quickly. I remember one time one of our trucks got hit with an IED and improvised explosive devices, a roadside bomb. And I called over the radio and was like, you know, hey, you know, Gator 2-1, let me know how you guys are doing. And like their car had literally just been blown up. And I come over like completely calm. And one of my sergeants was like, he's like, you sound like you were like ordering a pizza. Like you didn't even care. And I was like, well, again, if I panic, it's going to make everyone else panic. And then we're not going to be able to make clear decisions. So, you know, staying calm was a big one. Another one that actually you guys put into words, but we used to do that with our soldiers was kind of like the what if game, right? So like as we were going down the street in Iraq, we would kind of look around and be like, all right, well, if I take fire here, where am I going? If I take fire here, where am I going? What would be a good, if I was a bad guy, what would be a good place to hide over here? You know, what would I use if I was emplacing roadside bombs? And my platoon, my 20-man section, I think we were the only ones in my battalion, which is at the time, the way they divided us, we had essentially 7 maneuver platoons. So we were the only platoon that found weapons caches without someone pointing at us and telling us where it was. So a lot of times informants would come over and tell you where something is through like the intel channels. But my platoon would go out and we would find weapons hidden in the city. Because we'd basically think like the enemy. We're like, well, if I was the enemy, where would I put my weapons? Well, I wouldn't put them in my house because it's hard to deny that I own them if they're in my house. I would put them near my house, and I would put them someplace that was not tied to anyone. So we would search abandoned cars. We would search abandoned buildings and stuff like that. And that's how we would find weapons. And I'd bought you guys are familiar with Bud K, right? The knife magazine? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Who isn't?
Of course, yeah. I would buy stuff from there and have it sent to Iraq. So like they had like lock picking, like auto jigglers to like pop open cars and like some lock picking stuff. I bought the auto jigglers, sent them over, and we would have like a 30-50% success ratio on cars in Iraq. Just like I literally no training. I literally hand one of my specialists a set of auto jigglers that I paid for out of my pocket, and I was like, use these when we walk around the neighborhood and see how many cars you can open. And he's like, okay. He's just like jiggling and popping trunks all over the place. So
that's awesome.
So the what if game, staying calm. And then the other one is rehearsals, right? So running through things ahead of time. So you know, so the first time you do something, it's not under gunfire, under pressure, you know, and ideally you do the crawl, walk, run method, right? Or slow, smooth, fast, as you guys call it. You do it slow, make sure you're in the right movements, everything's going perfect. Then you kind of speed it up, and then eventually you kind of add resistance. So you know, whether you're doing force on force with some munitions is ideal. But when I showed up to my platoon for that second deployment, I actually met them for the first time in Iraq. So very similar to my first trip, I showed up in Iraq and I was like, hi, I'm new here. I'm in charge. I'm going to lead you in combat. And they're like, who the hell are you? And I was like, cool, this will go well. And one of the first things I did was like, all right, like show me how you guys clear rooms, how you guys would enter a building. And the method they had was a lot slower than I had done on my previous deployment. And we sat down. I built a glass house, essentially, which is just tape on the ground at one of the shooting ranges on post. And we repped things on a glass house. And we came up with how we were going to breach the door on that building. And we, you know, the army didn't give us ladders to use, so we grabbed some spare wood and we built ladders, and that's how we would breach doors. I mean, that's how we'd breach compounds, right? Because most of the houses in Iraq, it was an outer compound and then the house was in the middle, so you had to go through the gate. And I can blow apart the gate with explosives, But if you hit the wrong house a bunch, that it gets rolled real fast, and you're damaging a lot of doors, and you're making a lot of people unhappy. So we basically found the easiest way was just to unlock the door, and you do that by climbing over the wall. So we'd build ladders, and we made sure we had security, so we'd more than one ladder essentially, and one guy would hop over, and while the other guy pulled security, the other guy would unlatch the door, and we just flow right into the house or into the courtyard. So, yeah, staying calm. What if? Rehearsals. Those are my three I'm going with off the top of my head. Feel pretty good about that.
All right. And, you know, I know you spent a lot of time overseas, mostly Iraq, 44 months, I think. And we would love to come back and do a deep dive into some more of your war stories as well as your experiences there. Let's move forward a little bit. What happened after all the deployment? What has life been like after all that?
Yes. We're talking about like immediate post or just kind of like where my life went afterwards?
Whatever you'd like to talk about.
I guess we'll go with where my life went afterwards. So as to be able to pass all these military courses, I started training a lot, obviously. And I figured if I could run really far on like some of the toughest civilian events, marathons, triathlons, etc., I should be good at the toughest military events, right? So that's kind of why I started getting into endurance sports. And through my program at 5th Special Forces Group, they had some weird relationship with Under Armour. And I went and worked at Under Armour for like 3 weeks, and it was like the craziest 3 weeks of my life. I mean, I went to like Kevin Plank's house, the CEO of Under Armour. Like George St. Pierre was at the party. It was crazy. I sat through like a meeting with Cam Newton in the Under Armour headquarters, and I didn't know who Cam Newton was. And like people were like, Cam Newton's gonna be in the meeting, and I'm just like staring. And they're like, "Do you not know who Cam Newton is?" It's like I have no idea who that man is. So I was like, the quarterback is like, "Oh right, football, got it." And then kind of they were sponsoring an event called Tough Mudder, specifically World's Toughest Mudder. It's a 24-hour obstacle course race. You line up at the start line. They say go. You run around a 5-mile loop. You're doing 20 to 25 obstacles. Whoever does the most loops in 24 hours wins. So I come out to this 24-hour obstacle course race, World's Toughest Mudder. And I didn't realize it, but I'd been essentially training for this sport for like a decade. I just didn't know it, right? Because it combines strength application, so like doing obstacles and carrying things, and speed, essentially endurance running. And I showed up to the event, and then it requires being like super mentally tough and basically persevering regardless of what's going on. So I went out there for my first 24-hour obstacle course race. It's essentially a world championship event. It gets cold at night. You have to put on a wetsuit to survive because you're getting in and out of water, and it's like 40 degrees and windy outside. So not particularly pleasant. And a lot of people essentially quit when it starts getting really cold. And I basically survived the night and just kept moving all night. And I finished 13th. And at that point, that was like way better finishing results than I'd done in realistically like any other sport or event ever. And I realized like, hey, I'm pretty good at this obstacle course racing thing. So like I made like a hard pivot. At the time I was doing triathlon and natural bodybuilding and marathon running and like doing all these different sports. And I just like took a hard 90-degree right turn and just started doing all obstacle course racing. And the sport was new, so I started writing articles, like using examples from Runner's World and stuff like that as a template, and started producing content for the obstacle course racing world. Yeah.
Cool. You mentioned that you were nerdy in high school and you did theater and things like that. When did you start getting into the bodybuilding and the weightlifting and all that?
It's kind of towards the end of, or I'd say early college. My dad took me to the gym as like a little kid, and I lifted a little bit of weights then, but didn't really kind of like stick. And then when I got into college, again, the military, in order to be good at the military, you have to be physically fit. And I was scrawny. So I was like, I should learn how to lift weights because that will make me stronger. And I had a couple of friends who were into strength sports. Like one of my guys that was in my wedding party used to do like amateur strongman events. So I started training with him and just kind of stuck. And you know, consistency, just like martial arts, right? Consistency times time, like make it a decade, and then you get decent. You get decent after a while. So,
right. After about a decade, you can get decent in just about anything if you put in that time. Absolutely.
Yeah. When I interviewed Patrick before, he said it takes about 5 years to get good at about anything, and I thought that was pretty accurate. So
And then you did this hard pivot, and I know you nothing stopped you. You're world class at this, and you're trying to break some records. Tell us about that.
yeah, so I used again. Obstacle course racing was a new sport in 2014. I was only a couple years old, or depending on which championship you go with, you can consider it the first year, or the third year, depending on how we're looking at things, or fourth year rather. So the sport is new, but fitness is old. So I basically looked at all the other sports I'd done, and I just copied their models for success, right? Like there's an ultra runner named Dean Karnazes, ultra marathon man, who. Like his shtick, besides competing at events and doing well, he would also do these like insane endurance charity events where he'd run, miles upon miles and days, multi-days, multi-week things, and he'd raise money for charity. So I looked at him and I looked at myself and I was like, well, I mean, I can do that. So I was like, well, that's what I'll do. That'll be like my shtick, right? That'll be my hook. So I straight up, and I've talked to Dean since then. He's sponsored by the same supplement company, Hammond Nutrition. And I was like, hey, Dean, I stole your model. And he's like, oh, cool. He seemed pretty cool about it. But that's what I did. So in addition to competing locally at a bunch of events and doing some bigger endurance races, I started coming up like for about 7 years in a row. I was like, all right, I'm going to do something that's completely crazy. No one has ever done before that relates to obstacle course racing. And I'm going to raise money for charity. So the charity I partnered with most of the years was called Folds of Honor. They do scholarship money for kids whose parents were killed or wounded in action, which I just thought was like a really good cause. Because as a friend who's lost people in the military, coworkers and family, and not family, coworkers and friends, like my wife knows what she's getting into when she gets married to me, because I was on that path already. But like my kids are born into that situation. So the thought of like a kid having to grow up without their father or mother, because they died serving a country, just kind of like eats me up a little bit. And I don't, I want to, to me, they, you know, they, you should make things really easy for them. So there's some with Folds of Honor. That's kind of why I chose that partnership. And then on top of that, it's someone who's bettering themselves. It's not just like a free handout. It's like, well, here's money for college. Now go and do the college and make yourself better. I also like that aspect of it. So basically for 7 years, I was like, all right, let me do something completely crazy. And they run the full gamut. So let's see, it was like I did seven obstacle course racing marathons in 7 days at seven different venues. I did a 24-hour treadmill obstacle course race where I essentially ran for a mile on a treadmill, got off and did four obstacles and repeated that for 24 hours. I did a 48-hour multi-lap. I did a 6-hour treadmill OCR, but again, I put a hypoxic generator on my face, so it simulated being up near base camp 2 of Everest, so 21,000 feet. The side note: when I did that one, the hypoxic generator company, when I emailed them, I was like, "Here's what I want to do. Would you like to sponsor me?" And they were like, "We recommend you do not do that. It is unsafe." And I was like, you guys are buzzkills. And then I started getting panicky. I was like, I should really look into it. So I was reading like all these, I was deep diving into hypoxic medical journals and like trying to figure out like what am I about to like go into like some sort of serious problem? And then on top of that, it has again, super nuanced. It has an intake valve. So if you run out of oxygen, it pulls it in from the ambient air. I didn't want to cheat. So I tipped over the intake valve.
Oh my
Right,
goodness.
which also not a safe thing, not a good idea. But again, I trained up for all these things. I didn't just like wing it. I did like very specific training to prepare for all these things. I climbed the last one I did was I climbed the height of Everest while doing obstacles at Tough Mudder, New England. So there's a 10-minute documentary called OCR Everest. I'll drop it in the show notes below. It's free on YouTube. You can watch that. My friend's a professional filmmaker. He made it. And one of the other ones I did that my again, the same filmmaker came along for the trip was eight obstacle course race marathons in 8 days in winter. It was like in 2020 we did it, January 2020. It's like right before COVID hit. It was pretty crazy. But it was, yeah, like I would literally run 6 to 12 hours a day, We'd get into a pile into a van, drive a couple hours to the next venue, get out and repeat. Sometimes we slept in a hotel, sometimes we wouldn't sleep at all. We would just drive all night and repeat. So it's quite an experience.
That's incredible. I don't understand how your body, or I should say, I don't understand how your mind can let you do anything for 24 hours, let alone your body, because I can't even sleep for 24 hours. I can't eat for 24 hours. I mean, we Connor and I, you know, we've taught seminars all day long, but we still, you know, we take a break for dinner, we go to sleep, we wake up, we teach again, but, you know, maximum 8-10 hours. So I can't imagine doing anything for 24 hours straight.
It's an acquired taste. But you know, the mind is just incredible, right? And when I cross the start line of something, I give myself three options. I can speed up, I can slow down, or I can maintain the same pace. Those are my three options. Doesn't matter how I'm feeling. Doesn't matter if it's a good day. Doesn't matter if it's a bad day. I have three options. And I can pick from one of those three. I don't list quit in there because that's not an option. I don't list not quitting. That's not an option either. You know, I think there's a lot of people who talk about not quitting and things. And to me, those people tend to quit first because I think they're trying to vocalize their uncertainty and try to reinforce themselves to not quit, right? Like I don't go to work every day and walk into my boss's office and I'm like, hey, sir, I did not key your car this morning. He's like, were you going to key my car? Be like, no, I said I didn't key your car. It's like, why would you bring that up? I think the same thing applies for quitting, right? Like, there's no need to talk about it if it's not something on the table. It's just not a thing we do, right? So you just toss that away. And I got a lot of those mental things from selection and from combat where it's like, you know, if I trained legs the day before and now I'm walking around on patrol with my body armor and someone starts shooting at me, I can't be like, hey, no, not today. I did heavy squats yesterday. And now let's pause this fight and we can come back tomorrow and redo it, right? Like, that's not a thing we do. So I do the same. I have the same mindset when I go into these races, right? You show up and regardless of how bad your day is, you gotta keep moving forward, which is why you know, in all my obstacle course races, I've never had a DNF, which is a did not finish, right?
Wow. That is amazing. How many of these 24-hour obstacle course races have you done?
I've done the world championship 9 times, and then I've probably done another, I don't know, probably 9 or so from other smaller brands, and one in Australia, one in the middle of Chicago, Vermont.
Crazy.
So I've, you know, if you add up all the times I've spent on an obstacle course race in my entire life, it comes out to cumulatively over a month. It comes out to like 35 days, which is so high. It comes to the point where it's like embarrassing to tell people. Like, sometimes I don't like telling people what I've done at OCR because it's like, shouldn't you be doing something else? And you're like, I probably should be. Like,
yeah. You know, a couple of things I want to say about that. One, well, it's a question as well, too. Just listening to you, I'm suffering already. And what's your mindset going into these races? Are you like, oh, my gosh, here we go, 24 hours, let's do this? Or are you pumped? Are you psyched? What's going through your mind?
It's a mix. It depends on the race, depends on the year, depends on the day. I will say after being in the sport for about a decade, I am less excited now than I used to be 5 years ago. And I'm also, I'll turn 42 this summer. My body has started to slow down and I notice it now. So I still do well, but I feel like I am, you know, fitness is a bell-shaped curve and I feel like I'm in the top back end of the bell-shaped curve. And I don't really want to see what the backside of that looks like. So I might do a little more relay team stuff coming up. I think I might have had enough of individual. But it really depends on the year. It depends on the competition. It depends on the prize money. Depends on it. There's just a lot. You know, sometimes I'm super motivated to get after it. Sometimes I'm just like, man, I should pick an easier sport. This was a lot of poor decisions have put me in this exact place. And I regret all of them right now. But yeah, I always joke, like, if I was better at short course stuff, I would do more short course stuff, but I'm not. And so, you know, ultra endurance is where we ended up.
I have to admit, I have your book, Ultra OCR Man, and when I first looked at it, I thought it was Ultra OCD Man, and you know, now that I think about it, it is a little OCD. You've got to be kind of out of your mind to be doing things like this over and over and over again. To me, it's amazing. It's amazing. It's incredible.
Thank you. Thank you.
So let's you know, that it's clearly the accomplishments you've had in this sport is you know, elite, world class, definitely. And I'm still impressed. I remember you said, "Hey, let's go practice together, and I'll show you how to do it." I was like, "No, my legs already hurt just you saying that." So I think I'll pass. But acknowledging that, let's move on to your martial arts training and how you got into martial arts. Is it something that you've always loved since you were a kid, or you got into it because of you were in the army?
Yeah, so the you know growing up, I like we talked about G.I. Joe, Arnold
Mm-hmm.
Schwarzenegger, Sylvester Stallone, right? I did have like a small Bruce Lee phase. It wasn't quite the as influential as you do, but I watched the Bruce Lee movies growing up, so I always kind of liked that. I did one summer, I did Muay Thai and Kenpo Karate for 2 months while I was waiting to go to like some army training. And then I didn't really do much of it. I did a little bit of combatives, early days of the army. And then kind of as my obstacle course racing career started, it doesn't look like it's tapering off. In my mind, it's tapering off. I can assure you there'll be less races in the future. I started increasing the martial arts side, and I like, you know, when I conduct a self-assessment, again, I'm kind of when we talk about like the super killer Green Beret guy, right? Like that ideal, you know, stereotypical view of one. When I start comparing myself to him, I see gaps in my training and my ability. And I was like, well, I don't want to be like I want to be the exaggerated persona. I want to be the superhero, right? Growing up, I love superheroes. Like I literally want to be that person. So I started realizing there's gaps in essentially my close range stuff. So I started training Kenpo Karate. Just because that's what I had trained when I was early college. So I found a Kenpo Karate place, trained there for a couple years, and then I moved. And when I moved again for the Army, I kept doing Kenpo Karate, essentially distance learning. I go back to Kansas City once a month and train with my instructor there. And then the gym I started training at locally does Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, Kali, and Jeet Kune Do. So I started training all of those. And basically what I found was I get a bunch of stuff in person, right? When you go to these classes, and sometimes they give you stuff to practice, and other times they don't. So it depends on the course. Sometimes there's not that much to practice, but I wanted to supplement what I was doing in person with other resources, right? So when I look at how I approach school, when I look at how I approach the military, when I look at how I approach obstacle course racing, it's all the same, right? I like read as much as I can on the topic. I watch videos slash get some sort of professional instruction. And then I repeat ad nauseam. Like you repeat so many times that you, not until you can do it right, until you can't do it wrong. Like it feels wrong to do it wrong, right? You know? So that's essentially what I was doing. So, and when I looked at my martial arts stuff, I was like, well, let me see what's available online to like augment my training. And that's how I found you guys. I got an email from Black Belt Magazine. It was like, you know, here's a knife course. And I was like, you know, I don't know that much about knives. I was like, for someone who collects knives, I had like, you know, 50 plus growing up as a high schooler. I think I was close to 100 at one point, and then I started giving some away because it was just too many. So I stopped for probably a decade, and then since I found you guys, I have started collecting again, which is well.
Sorry about that.
You can apologize to my wife. You can apologize to my wife. If anyone ever breaks into my house, the jewelry armoire that's in the main dining room, that is not has no jewelry in it. It is just knives. And sorry to bother you. Sorry to disappoint you. The really nice ones aren't in there. They're in a separate location. Those are like the cheap ones. So don't steal that one. Or I mean, you could, but it won't bother me that much. So I basically. Any sort of in-person martial arts I took, I started augmenting it with online training. And when I looked at the different ranges of combat, right, you know, projectile and striking weapon and then kicking and punching and trapping and standing grappling and grappling, I was like, well, I don't want to be like a, I want to get a black belt, right? I think that's like a general accomplishment that most people who enter the martial arts have that goal. And I was like, but I don't want to be a black belt who's like only good at one thing, right? And then like you think about UFC 1 in 1993 and these like high level martial artists going in there and just getting like completely handled by grapplers. And you're like, ah, man, like I didn't want to be that guy. So I was like, well, I need like a little bit of training in all ranges of combat there. And I just started, like I did with everything else, just started obsessively deep diving into things.
Very cool. Let's go back to Kempo, because that's where you got your black belt from, correct?
Yeah.
What about Kempo drew you to it?
I like that it was you know, there was no, when they teach you some of the techniques, there's no rules, right? So like you can eye gouge and you can 12-6 elbow, right? I can kick the guy in the groin. I can bite him if I really want to, right? So I like that there was a bunch of moves that were kind of like no holds barred type thing. And I wanted some of that traditional base. You know, a lot of people get into, like, as I've gone through some, I've had some friends that do BJJ and MMA, and they're like, why don't you just do MMA instead of like reconstructing it from the ground up by yourself? And it's like, I like understanding the why of why things were developed a certain way, right? Like, you know, why Wing Chun does certain things and why karate, the stance is low and that hands go back to the side, which is like, you're not going to fight in a karate stance, right? Like that's not a good stance. You can't really move forward and backwards. Your hands are not by your face protecting yourself. So I liked kind of deep diving that and understanding why. And that's, it was just a, from my experience in early college, it seemed like a good starting place. So that's, and there was one, when I looked at the gyms that were within, you know, 30 minutes of my house, that was one of them. And I kind of looked at that. It was like that, Taekwondo, or like 10th Planet BJJ. And I knew at the time, I wasn't interested in BJJ at the time. So I went to Kempo.
Very cool. Congratulations on your black belt. You got that last year, correct?
I did, yeah.
What did it feel when you wrapped it around your waist?
I wasn't expecting much. I was just like, yeah, it's another rank. You know, like I've got a bunch of accomplishments. And I felt a little, I'll be honest, I felt a little emotional. It was like a big, it was like the first kind of like big step in like my martial arts journey. And you know, it's not a conclusion necessarily, but for me, for Kempo, it kind of was, just because I was traveling back and forth for it. So I ended up stopping shortly thereafter and focusing on the stuff that's, where I don't have to drive 2 hours once a month in each direction to train. And then it was, again, on a personal note, that was like the first big accomplishment right after the passing of my mother, who died of cancer last summer. So it was, I remember being like a little choked up afterwards, and like I'm talking to my wife. It was just like, you know, she's missing part of my life story now. So, yeah.
And, sorry about your loss there.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. Sorry for that. You obviously, you're super dedicated, and now you're focusing on Jeet Kune Do and Kali and Army combatives and Jiu-Jitsu, right? So tell us a little bit about those different styles.
Yeah, the Jeet Kune Do, I really just a lot of pad work. I'm used to like holding pads and the transitions between punches and kind of how one thing flows into the next. I really like that. You know, obviously there's like a Wing Chun influence there, so that we do some trapping there, which I liked. I also, kind of like we were talking about, I started taking some like online Wing Chun stuff. So I do know the forms of Wing Chun beyond the forms. Like my Wing Chun is straight trash, right? So like I technically have a certification in Wing Chun. That being said, it's basically just mimicking the forms. And the reason I did that is, one, I wanted to improve my Jeet Kune Do by understanding where it came from. And two, this is a good one. Yeah, I'm sure you enjoy this one. Like when I watch the Ip Man movies, you have no idea what's going on when they're I was like, I want to know what's going on. So I was like, I want to learn the forms. So when I got COVID a couple of years ago, I was like, well, let me start learning Wing Chun forms. I sat in my room, you know, and there's, you know, like Si Lim Tao and the early forms. There's, you're not like sweating, right? So you can do it even if you're not feeling particularly well. So, So I did some Wing Chun certification stuff to help support that. And Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, I think I was talking to Conrad about it. Like, I did not like it for probably over a year. I was just like, it's like there are just large people just crushing my soul. You know, that it just seems so complicated. And you go to class and like every day there's more techniques and you're like, what? You know, it feels like, you know, boxing, there's like, it's like we have four punches and you're like, cool, I can get behind that. And then I just refine it. You know, and even a lot of the karate stuff, there's it feels like there's a set amount of moves and then you just, how you combine them is different. But then when I go to jiu-jitsu, it's like, all right, well, here's this move. Oh, but you need to turn your arm this way, not this way. Oh, no, which way your hand? Oh, no, your hand's all wrong. No, you need to drop your hips. It's like, well, I know, it's like, but are my hips moving? They're like, no, your hips aren't moving. Just like drop your body weight that way. And you're like, what? So it's just so nuanced. But when I was interviewing one of my friends who's also a black belt, like Dr. Conrad, he has a quote that I steal and I use all the time, that Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu works in real life the way Kung Fu works in movies, where like, I mean, once you get good, you can manhandle people, and these like grown men and they can't do anything. It is wild. So we have the Army Combatives program is largely based on Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and a little bit of Muay Thai. And then weapons retention stuff. And every other week we have like 20-year-old kids, some of them who outweigh me by 50 pounds will come in, and I'm a blue belt, right? So I'm not even that good. Will come in and I can literally do what I want to these people. And it is, you know, it's just like us, and the rest of the guys I work with are all better than me. They are levels upon levels better than me. And I'm just like, this is insane. Like I'm literally choking people out. And like having a conversation with one of my coworkers about something related to work at the same time. And then, you know, like my attention split and I'm still doing fine and still not putting in a lot of effort. So it took me a while to enjoy it. Now that I've got more training, it is one of my favorite ones just because, you know, you can do fully resistant opponents and it's like human chess. It's so super intricate. So, and then you don't get like brain damage from getting punched in the head a lot. So that's super cool too.
I'd like to just leapfrog off that. It is one of the few training methods where two people can go at it basically full force and have it relatively safe. And so it's just a great way to train.
Yeah. So baby, with the Army, I got to go through the amount of I've trained in the last year is just like, it's seriously a ludicrous amount. I mean, between like my normal Jeet Kune Do, Kempo Karate, and Kali classes, and then all like the online courses I was taking with you guys. And then I was training up for like the all Army competition for a couple of months. And then I took the basic Army course, which is 40 hours, and the tactile course, which is 80 hours. And then the master's course was 160 hours. And then I took the Air Force basic course. It's another 40 hours.
Wow.
I mean, like that was all in the last year. So it was just like tidal waves of information. And it just, I've gotten a lot better in the last year is what I'm saying. I'm still felt several levels below my coworkers, but you know, I feel like when you get to blue belt, you can, you can handle untrained people pretty well. Even now that I'm, even the wrestlers, like I used to have a lot of problems with the wrestlers when I was like a more senior white belt, and just even kind of that a little more experience, I now have less problems with the wrestlers. Like sometimes they're still all over me, but and they're typically about 20 years younger than me as well. So super cool martial art.
It is. And like what you were saying, at first you've got to be prepared to have your soul a little crushed and let go of that ego. But once you get over that hump there, I've seen a lot of people, myself included, go through a very similar journey as you did. You know, you get over that hump and you realize, wow, I'm doing better. I'm handling younger people heavier than me a little better. And it just gets fun from there. Absolutely. Let's move forward to I know you have a website that you maintain, a strength and speed website, and some books that you've written. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so my website's teamstrengthspeed.com. My company is called Strength and Speed, primarily obstacle course racing company. But it was really meant to be like a multi-sport fitness company, because I got tired of, as I bounced between sports, I got tired of like switching who I was representing. So I'm like, well, I'll just make one brand that represents everything. So it really kind of follows, the brand really follows what I'm currently into. So yeah, for a while, it was a lot of like bodybuilding, marathon running type stuff. And then for most of its existence, it's been obstacle course racing focused. And now it's got like a martial arts section, as well as like a Christianity section, are kind of the three pillars. Fitness, fighting, and faith is what I have it on the website. But teamstrengthspeed.com.
Cool.
Got a podcast in addition to this one, obviously. We've got, I don't know, 200 plus episodes. I've written about 350 articles at this point. Got 8 books. Most of them are very obstacle course racing specific. If you enjoyed some of the stuff I've said on the podcast or want to know more, there's a book. My biography is called Ultra OCR Man. It's on digital hard copy and Audible. I recommend the Audible just because you can listen while on a run or driving to work. Makes it super easy to kind of get that information in. And then my other books are usually, I've got one about like endurance obstacle course racing, one about shorter course obstacle course racing. One's like a workout book, which kind of lists a bunch of workouts. The Sponsored Athlete, we've talked about that on the podcast before. And then my other one, more generic one, is just one called On Endurance. Basically, I took lessons learned from the 200 plus podcasts I did, and I kind of simplified them out and made them into like a list format of like, if you want to improve endurance, whether you're doing a 5K, a 10K, a half marathon, a full marathon, a 24-hour race, whatever it may be, here's a bunch of steps and things I could recommend, like mental tricks you can play on yourself in order to improve your endurance and perform at whatever distance you want to perform at. And then, like I mentioned, the OCR Everest documentary free on YouTube. And then I have a 24-minute professionally produced documentary my friend made that is also linked on my website called Ultra OCR Man. That one's like it's like $10 off the website.
That's crazy. Yeah. But just describing all those things, you're an athlete, you're in the military, you're a father, you're a husband, you're a writer, you do podcasts. How do you make time for all that? This is incredible. You're just extremely efficient.
Yeah. I stopped watching TV. That was like probably the biggest one. I just like hard stopped. When I was deployed in Iraq, we watched so many movies, and I came back and I was just like, I'm just tired of like watching other people live their lives and not being able to do anything, right? Because when you're in Iraq, you're stuck on a base. So you go work out, you go on missions, and then you basically just sit around the base, just kind of waiting for the next thing to happen. And then the kind of big part, right, is a lot of it's just drive and consistency over time. Like I'm not, you go through an average day with me and you'll be like, oh, well, like, I mean, that was tiring or busy, but it wasn't like super crazy. Mm-hmm. But if you just be consistent, and we take that and times it by 5 years, 10 years, et cetera, it becomes almost impossible to keep up, right? Like mm-hmm. I didn't sit down and write, you know, 300 articles at once, right? I would, you know, a couple hours one day I'd work on it, a couple hours the next day I'd work on it, a couple hours the next day. Same thing with the books, right? Like it takes me about a year to 2 years to write a book, and I'm usually working on like one or two at a time, just kind of throwing my thoughts down on paper. And then my dad helps edit them. I have a friend named Amy Padgett. She helps edit them as well. And then I just slowly release them over time. So some of it's the work's backloaded, where like I'll do the work and then release it slowly over time. So it looks like I'm busier than I am sometimes, when sometimes it's only a couple of days of like really hard work spread out over time. And I'd say the drive comes from, you know, my friends, right? So my college roommate, Jonathan Graspa, was killed in Iraq on April 7th, 2007. And I was like, well, if he didn't get to come home and live a full life, like I need to live two lives to make up for his life. And then same thing with, you know, other Niall Yates, one of our soldiers we lost, and one of my friends, his wife, Shannon Kent, she died in 2019 in Syria, right? So, and I look at other soldiers and peers and friends of family members of friends and stuff like that that have died overseas. And it's like, well, you know, if they didn't get a chance to come home, I need to make up for that. So just kind of go all in. And then I have a very last part I'll say is I have a very understanding wife. So an extremely understanding wife. And I set the bar pretty low by like essentially dating her and being like, cool, we're dating. I'll be in Iraq for the next year. I will see you then. See you in a year. Like I literally, we've been dating for like 6 months. And it's like, I'll be back in a year. I don't know what to tell you. And that's it. We've gone for a year, came back a year later and picked up our relationship. So I set the bar pretty low pretty early. So.
Yeah, that's very understanding of her, and you're a very lucky man. And anything you'd like to wrap it up with, Evan?
No, I'm just excited to be here and be helping out with you guys. And I really believe in the program, which we've talked about numerous times. And I think I really like how TIGA Tactics and the combatives fits. You know, it doesn't replace what you're doing. It fits into your other skills, the other martial arts you're training. And that's what I really like about the program and simplicity. So I'm always working on, you know, follow my website, follow my Instagram, my social media, all that stuff will be in the links below. Always working on new books. I'm pivoting away from obstacle course racing world slightly and pivoting more into the martial arts world. Just because I feel like I've run my mouth about obstacle course racing about as much as I can. And I don't really have anything new to say. It's like I'm just repeating the same stories at this point. So I want to start shifting more into martial arts and kind of blending some of those worlds. And for my sport, if I'm not, I can grow my sport two ways: obstacle course racing. I can help retain people in the sport, or I can help bring new people into the sport. So that's some of my focus moving forward, is like bring new people into the sport, and then also bring some of the OCR people into like the self-defense world, which TIGA Tactics is sponsoring our professional obstacle course racing team for 2024. So they're one of the supporting sponsors. Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. And we're happy to have you in the martial arts world as well too. And we can't wait for you to improve and get more experience and have you run your mouth in the martial arts world. I'm excited for that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to, yeah.
We're super honored to have you be part of the team, and thank you for, you know, being open and discussing your life so far. It's incredible. It's been an incredible journey, it sounds like, and it just makes us even more humble that you've chosen to be a part of our team.
Yeah, just always, you know, I don't really believe in like resting on your laurels, right? I think not that you need to do something great every day or every week, right? But you know, I don't like just kind of being like, all right, well, I did that stuff, and you know, there's some people who get their Green Beret and they're like, well, I'm a Green Beret now I can be, I don't have to work out anymore. It's like, no, you got to kind of like earn that thing every day, kind of like,
right.
Kind of like the black belt, right? Like if you,
right.
if you get it and then you're like, all right, well, I'm going to stop training and you know, that's basically it. Then, you know, that's really not really the point. Right.
Absolutely. I like how you said it. You have to earn it every day.
That's right. Yeah. You know, even if like, I mean, to criticize myself, right. I got my karate black belt and then stopped training karate, right. But I'm still training all these other styles. Right. So they still build upon each other. And I am not mm-hmm. as good as Conrad's making me feel bad when we were discussing his background. And he's like, I do all my forms every month. And I'm like, ah, Conrad. It's like, man, I got to start doing that now. It's like, I don't have time for this. So I'm going to have to step up my game, you know, and the meeting you two was also eye-opening for me, because I realized that it's not without precedent that people do multiple styles and are highly proficient in multiple styles. So just like I took Dean Karnazes' model for OCR, I mean for ultra running, and applied it to OCR, I've taken like you two guys and I've stolen some of your mindset, your martial arts kind of lifestyle plan, and applied it to myself. So just chasing black belts after you guys. So
awesome.
Hey, it's not a bad hobby. It improves your lives in so many ways. So that's exciting to watch your journey there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right.
Well, let's wrap it up. Thank you, listeners. If you hung out with us this long, we're glad to have you, and we're excited to see you at our next episode.
Sounds good. And I know you guys just released your, is it public now, the schedule for 2024? The seminars and everything?
Yes. So in the next, in this coming, well, for podcast listeners, you may be listening at any time. So it might be relevant I say this week, but yeah, in the next few days, you'll start seeing the full schedule, and hopefully they'll be able to check it out and see if we're close to their town or their state. And we invite them to come train with us in person, face to face.
Sounds good. All right. Again, we'll drop a bunch of usual links down below, social media links for Conrad and Patrick and then myself. And then some of the other stuff I've referenced on the podcast, my biography and stuff like that, if you want to know more, and the documentaries, et cetera. And then, again, train Tiga Tactics online. I think we'll do a separate episode on like what our thoughts are of like online martial arts training. But I think I think it has a lot of value to bolster and enhance whatever you're currently doing. I know I've learned a lot from watching other videos and then taking that stuff and repping it and applying it in various settings. So.
Absolutely.
All right, we're going to get going.
Thanks you, everybody.
Again. Thanks, everyone.
All right. Bye.